It's time to talk about Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. And now, here's Ira.
It's not often that I have a guest who has been performing for decades and is still going strong and making people happy. He's Mickey Dolenz. He's performing a special Valentine's Day performance at the Strat February 14th at 8 p.m. It's part of his ongoing Songs and Stories tour. For ticket information, go to thestrat.com. For everything about Mickey, go to mickeydolenz.com. You can follow him on Facebook. Well, Mickey, what can I say? Welcome to the show. Thank you. I promise you I'd ask you an insipid question before we got going and talk about your tour and especially the Troubadour and a bunch of other stuff. Why are you spelled M-I-C-K-Y instead of M-I-C-K-E-Y?
I have no idea. My parents would have made that decision at some point. In the early days of my childhood, I've seen my name spelled with an E. But then when I was a teenager, I changed it. I changed the spelling entirely to M-I-C, the number 7, K-E-Y. But the 7 was silent.
Sounds like the Mickey Mouse Club, Mickey Dolenz Club. I like it.
Yeah. No, it's just M-I-C-K-Y.
Okay. I like it. That was my intention.
Not to be confused with a mouse, I guess. I don't know.
No, not at all. Not at all. I have to ask you, who influenced you the most in your professional career? Was there one person in particular?
In what capacity? Acting, singing,
well,
directing,
if there's more than
writing?
In all of them or any of them, was there one or maybe more who you just...
Oh, yeah. Well, there was somebody different in every, in every field, I guess. In music, which I think everybody's probably interested in, my influences as a teenager, young teenager, preteen, and then teenager before the Monkees would have been the Rock and Rollers. Chuck Berry. I tell a story about Chuck Berry in my show, as a matter of fact. Little Richard, Fats Domino, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Mathis, huge influence. So it would have been, those would have been the major big vocal influences in terms of what I like to listen to and sing, which is mainly, kind of hardcore old school rock and roll. In acting, I don't know. I mean, over the years has been many, many actors that I've admired and think are incredible. I think nowadays, I would have to say Tom Hanks, Hugh Jackman as an all-around entertainer. He's very, Hugh Jackman's very old school in the sense that he does it all, singing, dancing, acting, just everything.
Yeah.
I think he's like our modern day James Cagney. and then, directing would be Alfred Hitchcock, I guess, and I don't know. So it would depend on the field.
The one name you mentioned that struck me in a certain way was in your rock and roll narration, it was Johnny Mathis. And that's interesting that you looked to Johnny Mathis for either part of a style or part of an approach. What was it about Johnny that influenced you?
Oh boy, a good question. I mean, I'm not sure you can break things down like that in a mechanistic way. You can't sort of deconstruct it and all of a sudden you can't take it apart. You can't say, oh well, it was his tone, it was the words, the lyrics, it was his delivery, it was the inflection. I think, like in any art form in our business, all the art forms really, the whole becomes greater than the sum of its parts. So the answer to your question is he was just Johnny Mathis.
Fair enough. Songs and Stories, it's part of your tour. And as I mentioned, you're going to be at the Strat this Friday, February 14th at 8 p.m. A lot of A lot of fans of Mickey and also the Monkees are coming to see you. Were you always aware of the impact that you and the group had on listeners, on live audiences, on the public in general? Or was it so initially, obviously, it was overwhelming, I would imagine, at that age to have that kind of impact. But as time goes by and you see the impact you still have on audiences, are you still amazed, or do you understand the, not to use the mechanistic word used earlier, but are you aware of what that impact is?
I am now. At the time, no. At the time, I was, well, mainly working 12, 14 hours a day. I tell the story again in my show of hearing the first single, the first Monkey single on the charts, hearing it on the radio, and I don't even remember them telling me which one it was going to be. As you may know, we had very little control at the time. But also, back then, there wasn't social media, of course, of any kind, and there wasn't really paparazzi. You could wander around and hardly be noticed, especially in L.A. Hollywood, where being a celebrity even back then was more like a piece of furniture because there's so many. So really, I didn't get much of a sense. When we went on the road in 68 for the or 67, sorry, for the first tour, that then obviously when all of a sudden we're playing to 10, 15, 20,000 kids and we can't leave our hotel and we have to have a police escort everywhere. Then, of course, you go, oh, I guess we're doing okay. but then after the Monkees went off the air, the show was canceled. There wasn't any group because the group was really, a TV show about a group. And when the show was canceled, the Monkees essentially didn't exist. There was no office or management or anything going on. And I moved to England, actually, shortly after, to be a director, to be a film and television director. And over in England, they knew who I was. The show had done very well. But I quickly became known as Michael Dolenz, the television producer and director.
Very nice.
And people didn't even mention the Monkees after a while. If I did an interview, it wasn't, or I went to a, an opening, it wasn't ex-Monkey Mickey Dolenz is seen at the Broadway. It was producer-director Michael Dolenz was seen at this opening, which was very nice. So until 86, when we came back for the reunion, no, I had no idea. In 86, then I got a huge dose of what it was like and how much it had meant to those fans and new fans, and what an impact it had had on the cultural landscape of the United States and the world.
It's interesting that to be the one that causes it and yet at the same time not be aware that you're causing it until much later that you had that cultural impact, pop cultural impact in particular. And you had, obviously there were three other members of the group, Davy Jones, Mike Nesmith, and Peter Tork. Did they all come to the realization at different times and places, unlike you? You were aware of it at a certain point. Were they all aware when you were aware of the impact, or did it come late to the game in some cases?
I have no idea. You'd would have to ask them. I couldn't tell you, frankly. I don't remember ever having that particular discussion. When I tell you these things or give you my opinion, it is only my opinion. I often get asked, well, what did the group think about this or that? And I say, there wasn't a group. I can tell you what I thought. Right. It was the cast of a television show. And as such, we all had our own independent feelings and thoughts and takes on everything.
And yet you came together as a group in subsequent years and decades and performed.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting stories about the Monkees. When we did hit the stage, and they clearly had that in mind because the audition process included singing, acting, and playing an instrument. And you had to be able to do all that to get in the auditions. So they clearly had it in mind that if the show even got on the air and did well, we would go out and perform. And we did eventually, hugely. And Mike Nesmith said it perfectly. He said, when that moment came, it was like Pinocchio becoming a real little boy.
That's a great turn of phrase. Yeah. It was. You had such a have such a long career in show business. Are there moments as you look back, either within the Monkey universe or outside of the Monkey universe? You mentioned your time in England as well. And it's interesting in a way that one of the Monkees went to England and the Beatles went to America. It's kind of a crisscross kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But is there one element of your career that you look at in a whole different light? Not necessarily the Monkees. You're directing in England, other stage performances you've done, et cetera. Is there one thing, Circus Boy, even if you look at it all, are there one or two highlights that you always carry with you?
Well, many. I mean, but again, it depends which decade.
Right. It's hard to narrow down, but you've had such a long career. I know.
I still remember stuff about Circus Boy. That was the first time I ever performed live singing on stage, actually. It was on a press junket for Circus Boy. So I remember that. And then, of course, high school, I remember doing plays in high school, in theater production. And then, of course, the Monkees comes along, and that was obviously humongous. And then, and I do, of course, remember lots about that. I have glimpses, you know, because people ask me which was my favorite episode. I don't have one because they all were the same episode. We filmed continuously. So it wasn't like we stopped an episode for a week and then started another one. It's all just one big long episode in my mind. And then touring the first time, going to England was huge because there was an enormous amount of respect for the Monkees and for me, even maybe more so than here, certainly amongst the hip-wazee, I call them, who frankly just didn't get what the Monkees was at the time.
Right.
They thought it was a traditional kind of group. I still have people asking me, well, what was it like when the group got the TV show? And I'm like, no, I'm sorry. You know, it was cast like you would cast a Broadway musical. I'm sure you know that. It was the cast of a television show about this group that wanted to be the Beatles. But it's interesting, and again, I tell this story in my show, it's interesting that on the television show, the Monkees never made it. We never were successful. It was the struggle for success that I think helped endeared it to everybody around the world. And we lived on a set. It was a set at Columbia Studios. It was a set of a Malibu beach house. And it does beg the question of how we could afford a Malibu beach house when we never got any work because we never were successful on the TV show. It was that struggle for right. success that I think was important. So that was huge, of course. Then I went to England. Like I say, there was much more respect there. And then I became very successful television producer, director, writer,
author.
Author, yes, for years. And then in 86, we had the reunion. Of course, that was huge, very, very big. And that lasted for 3 or 4 years. Then next decade, I fell into doing musicals, Broadway musicals, and big ones like Aida, the Elton John, Tim Rice musical on Broadway, and Hairspray in London, and a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, and Pippin, and I love that. That was truly a high point of kind of, it was all kind of coming together, but then in retrospect, that's what the Monkees was. It was a little musical on television, like the Marx Brothers. In fact, it was John Lennon that first said it, the Monkees are like the Marx Brothers, which is so true. The Monkees was a little half-hour Marx Brothers comedy with singing and dancing and a little adventure on television.
Were you Groucho or Zeppo or
Dumbo, I think.
Not really, no. Well, what's interesting about your career, it is a well-rounded one. You started obviously at an early age, but you, as you talked about your stage career as well, that's a heavy lifting when you're on stage and you're performing on a nightly basis. Not that touring is easy, but still, to be on stage and in a live performance, in a Broadway or off-Broadway kind of performance, that's takes stamina and talent and be able to do all that. So did you get a sense of fulfillment? I guess it may be a cliche question, but did you get a sense of fulfillment doing live theater versus movies or television or anything else that you've done?
Well, it's definitely a different job. It's a different technique. It has its own challenges, absolutely. It was incredibly thrilling. Especially since, like in Aida, I'd played totally against character. I was the villain. I was the bad guy in this musical called Aida. In Hairspray, I was this old father of a, you know, so in none of them was I, you know, Mickey the monkey. Right. So that was a thrilling to be able to do that and to get away with it. And supposedly very successful. They all have different challenges, like being on the road, doing rock and roll. The shows are the easy part. We have a saying, they pay you to travel. We sing for free. You've heard that probably.
Yes.
It is so true. So the traveling for me on the road is infinitely more difficult than doing the shows. I bill my tours now around the traveling, around airplane times and drive times. On Broadway, of course, you don't have that problem. And people would say to me, because you do 8 shows a week, that is true, and that is demanding.
Yep.
Especially when you're singing, light operatic, like those Elton John, Tim Rice scores, or in Pippin or something. Big notes, big voice. And 8 shows a week. The shows can be grueling. But people say, oh, that must be so difficult. And I reply, hey, I've done 8 shows a week and traveled 400 miles between each one. and on Broadway, you just get out of the theater. You go next door to the pub, have shepherd's pie and a single malt scotch, go home and go to sleep. So it's up and down. I mean, there's pros and cons of everything. But being live on stage, especially on Broadway, that's pretty, pretty phenomenal.
I would think so. Well, when you're traveling, there's that dichotomy, as you talked about, you're traveling X amount of hours to perform, and that's where you love it, and you're on stage performing, and even in your current tour as well, which is, again, February 14th at the Strat at 8 for Mickey's Valentine's Day special show. When you're traveling and you're not Mickey Dolenz, but you are Mickey Dolenz, but you're the human Mickey Dolenz just trying to rest and relax until you can get to the next stage, do you find that it becomes automatic? And what I mean by that is, once you're off the bus or off the plane, you get up on stage, you do a sound check, and then it's time for the show, you just automatically pop into Mickey Dolenz.
Well, there's not much of a difference now between, and really there never has been, between the kind of two Mickey Dolenzes that you're talking about. There was a definite difference between the person and the persona. On the Monkey Show, I played a kind of caricature of myself. We all did to a degree, larger than life kind of versions. But that's what they wanted. They didn't want total characters, actors that were playing an entirely made up character. That's the way they cast it. I played myself essentially, but sort of a me on steroids kind of wacky, crazy thing. Davey more or less did himself, but exaggerated, of course, with sparkles in his eyes. Nez was, again, a an extrapolation of his dry, wry humor. Peter was the only one that actually had to play a fairly different character. On the television show, Peter played the dummy, we called it. He was the one that was like the Hunts Hall character, the one that was always, what? Oh, whoa, I don't know, that kind of thing. And that was totally against his character. He was one of the smartest, well-read, well-educated, brilliant intellectuals that I've ever met. So he had a tougher job, I guess. But when I'm on stage now, there's very little difference between, I don't run around backwards, going,
You mentioned Hunts Hall. Who was Leo Gorcey in the group?
That's a good question. That probably was me.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah, probably was me. Yeah.
Let's talk about your tour and actually, well, I want to talk to you about two things, your album at the Troubadour. But before that, your show that's going to be coming to the Strat, again, February 14th at 8 p.m. How did you work out the balance between stories and songs? And is it in narration form? So you start at a certain point in time, and I should say maybe not narration form, but a linear form where you're going from one point in time to another, and then you intersperse it with songs?
No, not quite. Well, the way it came about, I have always ad-libbed between, we always did when we were on stage, even as the Monkees. We would ad-lib and have bits. We'd call them shtick. And we would do that because the fans loved it and they expected it because of all the shtick we did on the television show. So we always did that to a degree. And then in my solo shows, which we're talking about, I always have done little bits of chat between some of the songs. I'll talk about the songwriters. I'll talk about David or Peter or Mike now to some degree. And over the years, I just started extrapolating on some of the stories. And one day I wanted to tell a story. And I said to the audience, do you mind if I tell you a story? And they said, yeah. And I did. And I wasn't sure if everybody would go for it. I thought maybe they just wanted solid rock and roll music for 90 minutes, And they loved the stories. And the feedback came back great. And the reviews came back great. Because the stories, I'll tell you briefly, I'm not going to give them all away because you come to the show to hear that.
Understood.
There's, for instance, stories about, well, I said Chuck Berry. And there's stories about Stephen Stills, stories about Jimi Hendrix. Well, everybody knows the famous story about Jimi Hendrix. Well, opening for us, I don't know if you know that, yes, but I assume you did.
Right.
And story about Elton John. And the stories are very interesting. They're not linear in the sense of a time frame necessarily, but the punchline of all the stories is a song, an appropriate song. So it's a story going into a song. So it's not a one-man show like, well, I started out very young. And here's a picture of me as a baby in the bassinet. Right. Not quite that. But it is songs and stories. But all the stories have a punchline. And like I say, the punchline is kind of the song, which is connected to the story.
And I assume that some of those songs connected to the stories are Monkey songs in some cases.
Some and some not.
Right.
And some not. That's what I also discovered. As a matter of fact, I used to do a song. It was the Chuck Berry song. I won't tell you what it is.
All right.
And people used to look up, why is he covering a Chuck Berry song? Then I told them why, and it all made sense. And then they immediately appreciated it. So no, some of the songs, like the ones I mentioned, they're not Monkey tunes.
Right.
But there is a connection, always.
And talking about your Live at the Troubadour album, you recorded that, and are some of those songs that are live at the Troubadour featured in the performance this Friday of February 14th?
All of them. Yeah.
Okay.
All of them. We've evolved it a little bit. We've flipped some stuff around, put some stuff in, took some, you know, a little bit. But the thing to remember in any of my shows is everyone gets all the monkey hits they ever wanted. We always do all the can't not do's, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, we run out of the building, I think, if you didn't do it.
Exactly. So I always make sure that everybody knows that I always do it and always have and always will. I always fulfill that kind of contract that I think you have with an audience is somebody in my place. They're there to hear those big hits. And my audience is now, I think, are fairly confident when they come. No matter what else I do, they know they're going to get those big ones. They're going to get Clarksville. They're going to get I'm a Believer. They're going to get Pleasant Valley Sunday, Stepping Stone, Daydream Believer. And once they know that, over the years I've discovered, once they know that, you can kind of go off and do other things. You can do deep album cuts. You can do other material. It does help, I discovered, that if you do other material, it should have some sort of a connection, and all of mine do. And, you know, that seems to work as long as they know they're going to get those big hits. In their entirety, no medleys, flat out rock and roll.
I think that's a very wise way to go with performance. A lot of performers I've talked to over the years don't necessarily enjoy singing their hits. They'd rather just do other songs. But I think you've got the nail in the head, or the head in the nail, or whatever that is, yeah. how it appeals to your audience. Before I let you go, Mickey, are you planning any other projects once this particular tour is done?
Well, this is not a tour like for years, like I've done in the past.
No, understood. Right.
I ain't doing those anymore. No, I'm doing fly dates, we call them. Right. I always have other stuff in the works. I have things I'm writing with partners. I have other interests. I do have other stuff planned and thinking about, like recording, for instance. Nothing to really I can talk about right now because it's just not developed enough. But sure, I'm always thinking of other stuff. Right now, I'm promoting this new album, Live at the Troubadour, that I did as a charity concert for Make-A-Wish, my favorite charity, my go-to charity, Make-A-Wish. And so that's what these current string of shows is all about. Yeah.
Great. And I just want to mention, too, you recently performed in L.A. to help raise money for the disastrous fire situation there.
And oh boy.
That's a whole other thing. But before I let you go, we won't end on a down note. We'll end on a great note, which is, are you going to write another book?
Not at this point. I don't have anything in the works. I thought about it occasionally. Not sure what kind of book it would be. The last one I put out was I'm Told I Had a Good Time. but it was a picture book. Essentially, a huge coffee table book. In fact, you've heard of a coffee table book. Well, this one was the coffee table. Huge thing with thousands of pictures. And that was from my childhood. But instead of writing down an autobiography, again, I did one in the past. Instead of that, we decided do it all in photographs. We have enough. And I think it's much more interesting. But no, I don't have anything in that genre to talk about. I do have stories and books and even maybe a novel that I've been thinking about, but then again, doesn't everybody?
Yeah, but you're keeping that creativity going, which is the important thing. And so there may be another, not a coffee table book, maybe a tea table book. Who knows? We'll get
right.
To Mickey Dolenz. Hey, thank you, Mickey. My guest has been Mickey Dolenz. He's performing a special Valentine's Day performance at the Strat, February 14th at 8 p.m. It's part of his ongoing Songs and Stories stage tour. And for ticket information, go to thestrat.com. For everything about Mickey, and that's without an E, go to mickeydolenz.com. Follow him on Facebook. Mickey, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
See you next time.
You've been listening to Talk About Las Vegas with IRA. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world.